Right. If you would give your kind attention to our brother Stephen, we'll let him come forward and give us the exhortation.
Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning. Usually I have to speed off back to Pennsylvania for work, but this year worked out that I could come this morning and be with you, and I'm really happy about that. Our family this past week had the opportunity to spend a week up in Parksville, a week spent searching for shells and enjoying your beautiful weather, which over the past week was actually really quite nice. So we searched around for shells, we looked for sea stars, and actually there were a few starfish this year. Over the last few years we haven't been able to find any, but this year there were some around, which we managed to find. And we, of course, dug in the sand and made sandcastles. And if you look around the beach, you'll find countless parents and children making sandcastles in the sand, building structures that will ultimately be destroyed by the tides. Actually, for us this past week, that was sort of the point of making a sandcastle. You make the sandcastle and enjoy it and then also watch it be destroyed, and that was part of the fun. But why is it that as human beings, we like to spend so much time on things that disappear so quickly? Why is it fun to dig in the sand and to shape it and make a creation that lasts but for a moment? Now, there are lots of things that we spend our life doing that don't last very long. And Victoria is known for flowers. You have a flower account in February where you brag to the rest of the country of how many flowers you have in your beautiful gardens. But it takes a lot of effort to make a beautiful garden. And people spend a lot of time making their garden look perfect throughout the season. And this is a continual effort, something that you need to redo, renew. If not, your yard doesn't look so good. Now, we have planted a bunch of daffodils in our yard in the springtime because the deer don't eat them. We have deer that come through and munch just about everything. We've tried to hide a few tulips, but the deer somehow can manage to find them amidst all the daffodils. But the problem is that they die off, and then they look terrible. And that's the way things are with gardens, is unless you keep working on them, they don't last. Now, if you have the time and the money, you can take both sandcastles and flower gardens to the next level. In Parksville, later on this summer, they have usually a sandcastle competition where people fly in from all over the world to build these massive creations. And they do a lot of special things. They use special sand and they spray the sand afterwards so it lasts longer. But ultimately, all of this falls apart. And same thing with gardens. At UVic, I used to enjoy walking around Finnerty Gardens. And they maintain that. And throughout the year, you can see that they've changed it. They planted new things and taken things out as the year goes on. And if you really want to take it to the next level, we'll go to Butchart Gardens. All of these take time and energy and skill and effort because they don't last. Why do we like to create things? Why do we like working on projects like sandcastles and flower gardens? Is it a feeling of accomplishment? Is it the feeling of seeing something being created that we've done, a feeling of working with a goal or a purpose, to create something beautiful, to create something unique? Why are we not so happy with just a big pile of sand or a big pile of dirt? And ultimately, in these projects, as a sandcastle, you spend a lot of time working with just a big pile of sand, but if you just left it as that big pile, it wouldn't feel quite so good. You wouldn't feel like you'd accomplished very much. Now, sometimes people like to take things to the next level. You see this with buildings like the pyramids or skyscrapers or fancy architectural designs. Or in other fields like science and medicine where people design things, discover things. Some things are useful, some things that are not so useful. All of these are projects that take time and effort. And people often say when looking back on their life that when they're in the middle of these projects, that they were the happiest, working with purpose and energy. Why are we like this? Why do we enjoy these types of things when we're working on a big project trying to create something? Now, there was a billionaire who gave a talk at a university. And at the end, there was a question and answer session. And one of the students asked a question to this man and said, you know, you have all this money. Why don't you just retire to the beach and relax? And I thought his response was interesting. He said, well, you know, going to the beach is fun for a week or two or three or maybe even four. But after about 6 months of sitting on the beach, it's really kind of boring. And then he said, you know what? You know what's really fun? Is running a multi-billion dollar organization. That is actually quite a lot of fun when you're the boss and you get to run everything. So why is it that we find sitting at the beach with a drink in our hand appealing? But if that's your life, that's all you ever do, really uninspiring. Why do we sometimes have projects that we work on, hobbies, that we really wish that we had the time and energy to supercharge with resources? The movement of a hobby and interest to something, you know, that you could put time and money into, if only you had both at your disposal. Now, the former chief technical officer at the company I worked for used to say that our careers are sort of like baseball. You only get so many swings at the bat. Make sure you take the most at each of your opportunities when you come to bat. Take a good swing. Use that opportunity. So what do we do with the opportunities we have? What do we do with each of our swings at the bat that we're given? Do we build something that lasts or something that's here for a moment and gone the next? But then really, with a longer time perspective, what's the difference? Because everything eventually goes away. The legacy of some lasts a bit longer than others. But ultimately, everything that we do is sort of like sandcastles and flower gardens. They're temporary things. And this morning, in our reading in James 2, we read about a problem that they had in their ecclesia there, where people were focused on temporary things. There were people coming into their ecclesia, people of significance, people of standing, people of importance. And because of their position in life, they had the opportunity and the means to wear luxurious clothing. And this made a difference to how these people were treated, how people thought about them. And there were people who were coming into their ecclesia that didn't have these means or these opportunities, and they wore shabby clothing, we're told. To one person, they showed respect, and to another, they didn't show respect. To one, they showed honor, and to the other, less honor. But based on what? And if you base your opinion on the clothes that people wear, ultimately, you're basing your opinion on things that are inherently temporary, things that rapidly wear out, things that give an incomplete picture of the person. There are plenty of terrible people who wear very expensive clothing, and there's plenty of wonderful people who wear shabby clothing. And the vice versa is also true. The opposite is true as well. In our readings this next week, we're going to be reading about David in 1 Samuel chapter 16. And Samuel was going to anoint him as king. And God made a point to him in 1 Samuel 16 that Samuel needed to not value people by what he could see on the outside. 1 Samuel 16 verse 7 says, "The Lord seeth not as man seeth, for man looketh on the outward appearance, but the Lord looketh on the heart." To God, our outward appearance is sort of like sandcastles and flower gardens, inherently temporary, fleeting things. In fact, almost to emphasize this point, God gives to us bodies that don't last, that quickly degrade, that change, bodies that no matter what effort we put into them, don't last the test of time. For some people, this happens faster than others. And then there's people like Sister Peggy who don't seem to change forever. You know, in our society, we celebrate athletes, their ability, their athletic ability, and the potential that they have to do things that most of us can only, well, hope or dream about. But these athletes really only play at the highest level, usually into their early 30s, maybe into their early 40s if they're particularly special. For example, the American football star Tom Brady played football into his early 40s, but this year, finally, he said, "I'm done. He retired. I can't do this anymore." And that's what our lives are like. There's a limited amount of time we have and potential that we have to do things. So, if we're not supposed to focus on external things, then what? What do we base our opinions on people? You know, James 2, verse 1, it starts off and says that we are not to have the faith of Jesus with respect of persons. The NIV says favoritism. The New King James Version says partiality. And it's interesting, this word, respect of persons, partiality, favoritism, it's only found four times in our Bible. This occasion and three other occasions where in all of the other times it's used particularly and specifically of God. So for instance, Romans 2 verse 11, it says, "For there is no respect of persons with God." Or Ephesians 6 verse 9, "Knowing that your master also is in heaven, neither is there respect of persons with him." Or Colossians 3 verse 25, "But he that doeth wrong shall receive for the wrong that he hath done, and there is no respect of persons." All these other times, it's used as a characteristic of God. God doesn't show favoritism. God doesn't show respect of persons. So what's this mean? How does God not show favoritism? I mean, wasn't Israel a favorite of God? Didn't Romans 9 say that Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated? Didn't God favor Abel's offering and not favor Cain's offering? So how is it that God doesn't have favoritism? It seems like he does have favoritism. Well, if you look at actually the definition of this word, it seems to be particularly focused on somebody who focuses not on the outward circumstance, not on the intrinsic merit of something. So what it's really saying is God doesn't base his opinion on the outside. He focuses on something else. Well, what is that something else? Well, clearly the inward characteristics. So what are these inward characteristics that we're supposed to focus on? Well, James doesn't specifically tell us, but he does, I think, give us a really good clue. If you look in James 2, verse 5, what he says is that those rich in faith and those that love God, these are the ones that he has made heirs of the kingdom. I think it's interesting that he connects faith and love together. These are two things that are actually very difficult to quantify. How do you tell if faith and love are real? And how much there is? Can you tell it in yourself? Can you tell it in those around you? And James's answer seems to be that the way you can tell if these things are real is you have to look at what people do as a result. The litmus test, and I like chemistry terminology, is action. If you love someone, it will affect what you do. If you have faith, it will show in the things and the actions you take. Faith and love aren't easy to measure, and when they're real, they're not transactional. You can count a person's money to see how rich they are. You can measure how high someone can jump, how far, how fast they can run, to measure how athletic they are. You can measure someone's IQ to see how smart they are. How do you quantify how much they love or how much faith they possess? And while faith without works is dead, works without faith are certainly quite possible. And while true love will certainly display itself in a person's actions, there have been many people who have taken similar actions but haven't really been motivated by love. And this is really the challenge of rich people. The problem they have, how do they know if their friend or the person they're dating or even the person they're married to really loves them? Maybe they don't really love them, they just love their money. When faith and love become transactional, it usually means that it doesn't really exist. If you only do something for someone because of your expectation of what they will do for you, do you really love them? If you only believe in God, if you only have faith in God because of your expectation of what God will do for you, is that really faith? And yet the interesting thing about actions, both of these, about faith and love, is that they're inseparable from our actions. They build on each other. They propel each other. They create one another. How do you increase love? You increase love by acting in a loving way and doing this over and over and over again. And if you do, love will grow. Here's an example I ran across. There was a woman once who had a meeting with a psychologist, and she confided in the psychologist that she hated her husband and she wanted to divorce her husband. But she didn't just want to divorce him. She wanted to hurt him as much as possible in the process. And so the doctor replied, well, if that's really what you want to do, what you should do first is shower your husband with compliments. When you have made yourself indispensable to him, when he thinks that you are totally, completely devoted to him, then start the divorce action. Blindside him with this. This is the way to really hurt him if you want to. And so some months later, the wife returned for another meeting with a psychologist. And she said, I followed your course of action. I did exactly what you said. And he said, right, now is the opportunity. Start the divorce proceedings. She said, how could I do that? I've fallen in love with him again. You see, love grows and increases the more you show love. And faith is the same way. How do you develop faith? By taking actions of faith. By trusting, by believing, by doing things that faithful people do. That's how you build faith. By making it a way of life and how you live. If you do this, faith grows, faith flourishes. And the funny thing is, though, that both faith and love from the outside often seem really perplexing to people. Because it causes people to do things that you don't really understand, that don't make sense. People often say that people who are in love do crazy things that make no sense except for the two people who are in love. When faith changes someone's life, it can be really confusing to those around. If you don't understand their faith, suddenly their motivations change. Suddenly they're doing and deciding to do things that didn't make sense or wouldn't make sense from another perspective. I mean, all of you this morning decided to come here instead of sleeping in on a Sunday morning. To some people, that seems ridiculous. Here's a day off. Why aren't you sleeping in and taking advantage of that day off? I mean, do you really need to go to church more than on Christmas and Easter? That's the perspective of a lot of people. Now, James gives us, I think, one of the best examples of the confusing aspect of faith if you don't really understand it in the story of Abraham. Here is Abraham, who is willing to offer his son, a son that he had longed for, prayed for, wondered if it would ever come, and finally did come, and now he's going to offer this son? That makes no sense to anybody on the outside. But he was willing to do that because of his complete confidence and trust in his God, that his God would make everything right at the end. Or look at the other example of Rahab with the spies and helping them escape. Notice what she particularly asked for. If you turn to Joshua chapter 2, verse 12 and 13, it says there, "Now therefore I pray you, swear unto me by the Lord, since I have showed you kindness, that you will also show kindness unto my father's house and give me a true token, and that you will save alive my father and my mother and my brethren and my sisters and all that they have and deliver our lives from death." So she asked the spies to save her family. And the response she got was that if she wanted to save her family, they all needed to be in her house when the city fell. And so what we find is that it seems that her family crammed into her house on the wall all this time while the Israelites marched around the city. Now, I don't think they looked at this battle tactic and said, well, I really think the city's going to fall at this time. This doesn't look like a very effective tactic to march around the city. But that's where they were when those walls fell down. They were all in her house. How did she do this? Well, it's because she believed. And she had faith, and that faith impressed her family. Somehow she convinced her family that they were going to be there with her in her house all this time that the Israelites were outside those walls. Impressive degree of faith, being able to impress this on the people around her. You know, in contrast to this, Lot in Genesis 19 couldn't save his own family, anybody outside of his house, from the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. He went to them and said, look, the city is going to be destroyed. And they laughed at him, said, you're a fool. They mocked him. They wouldn't listen to him. When you dedicate your life to developing the faith in God and learning to love Him, to obey Him, and to living His principles, sometimes the things that you do won't make sense to those around you. And sometimes it may feel like you're missing out on life, that you're not living life to the fullest extent, doing everything you possibly could do. And yet, that is a matter of perspective. Because everything in our life now is inherently temporary. Riches, honor, power, excitement, vacations, family, education, relationships. All of these may be tangible things, but they're temporary things. Really just another form of sandcastles at the beach or beautiful gardens in the summer. And this is where the faith in God is different. God says, base your legacy on me. Put your faith in me. Demonstrate this by how you live your life, what you value and focus on now. Live my principles. Live my way of life. Choose to be part of my family. And if you do this, well, then I will share with you some of the aspects of my family, some of the characteristics of the people in my family, like immortality, like a freedom from temptation and sin, of being a part of my kingdom. And as members of my family, you will have the opportunity to create and achieve forever. Now, we come this morning to remember Jesus. And one of the things he said is that everyone that heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them not shall be likened unto a foolish man which built his house upon the sand. And the rain descended and the floods came and the winds blew and beat upon that house and it fell and great was the fall of it. But everyone whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken unto a wise man that built his house upon a rock. And the rain descended and the floods came and the winds blew and beat upon the house and it fell not, for it was founded upon a rock. And that rock is Christ. The stone that was cut out of the mountain without hands that break in pieces the image in Daniel. We all have a choice of where we want to spend our time and energy in life. We can spend it trying to achieve the things that people around us want to achieve. Things that ultimately are just like sandcastles at the beach. They're beautiful for a time. They're fun. They're enjoyable. But they're inherently temporary. or we can grasp hold on the salvation that God has offered to us, like Rahab did, or trust that God will make everything right, like Abraham did, and be doers of the word, like Christ demonstrated to us. And we come this morning to remember in these emblems before us, emblems of bread and wine, emblems that, while temporary symbols, represent to us eternal things.